This is Mental Health Exposed on Natural News Radio with Mike Bundrant.
Hi there, I'm Mike Bundrant. Welcome to the inaugural show of Mental Health Exposed. This show will focus on two goals. One, we're going to reveal the helpful practices and strategies that lead to natural mental health. And two, we're going to expose the incompetence and fraud in what we know as the mental health and personal development industries today. And there's a lot of it. You're going to be shocked. You might not always like what you're going to hear, but we'll raise questions. And most importantly, we are going to offer solid alternatives. This is a weekly show. We're going to feature interviews with leaders in the industry who have messages that buck mainstream trends and offer our listeners an education that simply cannot be found anywhere else. Today we're going to learn some amazing facts about psychiatry in our discussion with Dr. Peter Bregg, and he's a longtime reformer in the industry, and I really can't think of a more fitting guest for our first episode of Mental Health Exposed. Dr. Bregan is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist. He's a former full-time consultant with the National Institute of Mental Health, and he maintains a private practice in Ithaca, New York. He's the author of more than 20 books, including the bestseller Talking Back to Prozac. I first heard about Dr. Bregan in the 90s when I found a book called Toxic Psychiatry, in which he reveals their true history of psychiatry, and we're going to talk about that today on today's show. And His most recent book, called Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime, that's his most recent book. He's the author of dozens of peer-reviewed scientific articles, mostly in the field of psychopharmacology. Dr. Bregan has served as an expert witness for over 30 years in many civil and criminal suits, including product liability suits against manufacturers of psychiatric drugs. Major reformer in the industry, and it's great to have him on the show. Here are some things that we're going to talk about on today's show. Dr. Bregan addresses the true motivation behind the field of psychiatry and why they rely on medication as their primary treatment. And if you think it has to do with actually helping people, you should think again. Does psychiatry really know what to do with the mentally ill? Is the APA really interested in public health or something else? Why do they prescribe medication so readily? Do chemical imbalances really cause mental health and emotional problems? What's the core cause, the real cause of mental illness, and what can we do about it? You're going to be amazed at what Dr. Bregan has to say. Okay, Dr. Peter Bregan, welcome to Mental Health Exposed on Natural News Radio. Great to have you here.
Mike, I'm very glad to be here, and I'm very proud to be your maiden guest, your first guest on the show.
Yes, thank you so much. And you know what? As I think about it, I couldn't have found a more fitting guest for the first show, knowing what I know about you.
Well, and knowing what I know about you, we have this identical, well, I don't know if it's identical, but close to identical dual interest. One is critiquing the oppressive psychiatric model, and the other is promoting more natural, healthy, reasonable, rational, loving ways of helping people.
Yes, and I think it's so important to, it's a dual-pronged mission, in my view, of one, exposing the fraud and incompetence and dangers, quite frankly, and I know you know a lot about that, things that actually hurt people when they're going to someone that they trust will help them. And then the other side of the mission is to not just tear something down that's harmful, but actually build up something that can help people, natural health and healing through compassionate therapy and those kinds of things is just an incredibly valuable thing to promote as well. One of the things I wanted to ask you, you are known as the conscience of psychiatry and a reformer in the field. Tell me about that. What's that all about?
Well, it all began when I was 18 years old. I was a college freshman at Harvard, and a friend of mine dragged me away from my studies, volunteer at the local state mental hospital. And when I walked into the hospital, I was shocked by how these people were living, how they were being treated. It was a genuine bedlam snake pit situation. The year was 1954. It was just before the new antipsychotic, so-called antipsychotic drugs came in. When they came in, if you walked into the hospital, it would have looked like a population of completely subdued, passive, lobotomized people.
Right.
But this was just before that. So these people, they were having feelings. They were outraged. They were sad. They were lonely. They were openly crazy, some of them, but not many of them. They were always people who'd been abandoned, who were poor. And I just couldn't believe what I saw. I became a leader of the program and even authored my first book from the program as a really young guy, just out of college. Started it during college, and then some other students helped finish it. So I just knew right away that whatever psychiatry was doing in these hospitals was wrong, that it was more harm than good. And at the same time, psychiatry at that point in time was actually more open to psychological and social alternatives. We had, you could even take a residency in something like community psychiatry or social psychiatry. There were psychoanalysts, and as bizarre and orthodox as they could be, they still were talking somewhat with their patients,
right,
and somewhat listening to them. So you had that wing of the profession. So I was able to organize, eventually, after much conflict with the blessings of the superintendent, a case aid program where 15 of the students, we had a couple of hundred going through the hospital, but 15 of us who were really involved, each got our own patient. And we had supervision from a social worker. And right away, I ran into, you know, the defensive turf of psychiatry. The president of the local psychoanalytic association in Boston, actually, is a big deal, said, "Oh, you can't do that. You'll hurt the patients." I mean, these were backward patients. We were going to hurt them. There were no therapists working on those wards.
Right.
And we did talk the hospital into it. And in the first year, we got all but two or three of the patients out of the hospital.
Sounds like you discovered a major gap in the system, and you filled it. And, of course, the gap has to do with someone actually caring about these patients.
And I realized that, wow, this was something. People need these services. They need care. They need love. For some reason that I'll never know, I understood that right away. And I understood that watching insulin coma, shock with people, frothing on the floor because they'd been overdosed with insulin couldn't possibly be good for their brains. I couldn't believe the psychiatrist who told me it was killing bad brain cells, which is the old equivalent of now of we're correcting biochemical imbalances. There's no bad brain cells or biochemical imbalances to be killed or corrected. And I went into medicine simply to become a reformed psychiatrist.
Listen, let me ask you something, because you're suggesting that the medical profession, in the case of these patients in the hospital, is doing something wrong, and I don't think I'm not necessarily taking issue with that, but are you suggesting, though, that there's an alternative that really works? I mean, we're talking about people that have had psychotic breaks. We're talking about people who are really crazy. And what do you do with them? I mean, your average person is going to, and these are supposed to be trained psychiatrists. They're supposed to know what to do, but I'm not sure anybody does.
Well, actually, we do know what to do, but psychiatry doesn't know what to do. A person who, well, let's take the classic example and the person that's probably one of the easiest to help. Let's say the 17, 18, 19-year-old or a young person who has their first psychotic break. That is, they're hallucinating, maybe hearing things, feeling persecuted, maybe seeing bizarre things, maybe thinking their parents are conspiring with the FBI against them, or their parents are aliens come to harm them, or that they're an alien, and who are really freaked out and disturbed. What that human being needs above all else is the sense that maybe they just met somebody they could begin to talk with a little bit. Because psychosis is not a physical disorder. It's a loss, a complete loss of trust in other human beings. So that you go into a state of withdrawal into yourself, a state of fear, and always, always a state of humiliation where you feel you've been made worthless, and then you try to compensate for feeling worthless by imagining you're the center of the universe, but that doesn't work, and that gets you in trouble, and you just don't know how to have any value or how to protect yourself from this overwhelming terror you're feeling. Well, it's all about the loss of relationship, because sanity grows out of human relationship. We become people out of human relationship. We're born where if we were not given relationship, we would die. And if we were given minimal relationship, we would be or very disturbed, autistic, withdrawn, depressed. And we see that in the rearing of children all the time. So what the most disturbed people need is the simplest of all, and that is relationship.
It reminds me of the saying that sanity, people who are sane are sharing a reality, and reality isn't reality, it's a shared reality. We say education is important, and the people who don't believe education important are a little bit on the outside, but they're on the outside of an agreed upon shared reality. So
I understand what you're saying, but I think it goes a little what I would think is deeper than that. It's really not just simply an agreed upon reality. It's a trust that other human beings are real, that they exist and that you exist, that it's not some horrible, weird joke that you have to withdraw from or overcome with your own bizarre ideas. It's about people and trust and caring and connection. That's the shared reality. I think it's a different thing to say that Catholics have a shared reality or people in the 18th century have a different shared reality than people in the 21st century. It doesn't matter where you are in what culture or what society, human beings require, this is why it's beyond the shared reality concept thing, human beings require a caring, nurturing relationship in order to grow. And in order to remain sane, they have to have a certain trust of other people so that they're not constantly in withdrawal and terror.
And when they've lost that, then they create an alternative.
Exactly.
Which is all about what's going on in their own world. So it's a form of withdrawal from other people. It makes sense. Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Jay Haley. He's passed on, but...
Yeah, Jay used to be on my advisory council years ago.
Great. I mean, we know he used to pop people out of a psychotic break through family therapy, taking a teenager, working with the parents, reestablishing trust, and someone would come out of their psychotic break. I mean... no drugs involved. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about.
Well, it is exactly what I'm talking about. I was influenced by one of Jay's little tiny books way, way back when I was a resident in psychiatry. And I was back in probably 63 or so, I was the first resident to do family therapy. We didn't have any other, there were no family therapists. And I'd invented my own style of it and had these striking experiences with very psychotic people who were about to be shipped from our acute center either to the shock machine or to the state hospital. And with getting the whole family together, was able within a day or two to help them go back into the family. And it was just very startling to me. And absolutely, it's just about the only way to help, especially a younger person, but anybody who's dependent in a family, the only way to really help them is with a whole family approach. And there are examples of this throughout the world. I mean, in Lapland, Finland, and you can just Google that probably and find the program, they have a family intervention that the moment somebody's having a breakdown, and again, it's often the teenager or the young adult, they go right into the family, and they have what they call open dialogue, where the therapists talk with each other openly and with the family openly. And one of their sayings is that schizophrenia lies in between the people, which is a kind of a lovely concept. And they avoid, you know, just identifying one person as the problem. They use little or no drugs.
Wait, little or no drugs? It's possible to treat schizophrenia without the help of Big Pharma?
They're so successful that patients get better before 6 months, so they end up being diagnosed as schizophreniform, which is the technical diagnosis for the first 6 months, and they never even go on to be diagnosed schizophrenia. The disability is way down. Their unemployment's way down because people aren't getting so disabled. And very few people get antipsychotic drugs. They use a little bit of sedative sometimes, rarely a little antipsychotic drug.
Anybody see a problem with the Western model here? Just to prescribe medication first, to see it as a biochemical imbalance, as opposed to seeing it as a problem among people and working with those people. That sounds to me like what's really solving the problem here.
And that's optimally what you do. If you have a cooperative family, then one therapist, then I can handle a situation like that and help a person through a psychotic break. And it's one of the more gratifying things that we do. It's not like, you know, you get your lawyer, he's been a lawyer for 60 years or whatever. He's abusive toward his family. He's obsessive compulsive. He has no recollection of his childhood hardly at all. Helping that person's a real task. You don't see maybe a lot of progress unless that person really decides they want to turn their lives around. But with these young people who are having these psychotic breaks, they'll change in the first hour in your office. They'll hear that you're listening to what they're saying. You're listening to the terror. You're listening to the humiliation and the distrust. And when you tell them, well, it's okay, I'm not going to give you drugs. I tell them right away, person Joe, I'm not going to give you medication, and I never lock anybody up against their will. So here we are. We can just be together and talk.
All right,
and then slowed down, not like I'm talking now.
Right. And there you've established a context of trust. And here's the thing. What happened? In other words, how come conversations like this are not mainstream? I mean, why is this happening on Natural News Radio and not happening on Dateline NBC? I mean, why isn't, and what happened to the field? Why isn't it all gone this way? This is obviously the most effective, compassionate, and humane way to treat people. And the field has not gone this way. I mean, I know from having, I trained under someone who trained under Jay Haley, and he learned all of the methods, this particular psychologist learned all of the methods and systems theory and so forth for how to really help people. And I hate to say it, this man was a complete sellout. I was excited to work for him, but what I ended up getting is supervision as, have you referred them for medication yet? Because if we don't do that, then we can't get insurance reimbursement. That's what mental health counseling ended up being as part of that system. What happened? And I want you to answer that question right after this break.
You're listening to Mental Health Exposed with Mike Bundren on National News Radio. Love tea? So do I. Isn't it just fantastic when something that's good for you tastes great too? If you haven't tried Cali tea, you're missing out. How does nutty orange spice, white bubbly berry, or fruity cherry banana sound to you? This amazing loose leaf tea from Cali tea is a treat to your taste buds, and the health benefits are fantastic. From its antioxidants to its cardiovascular health benefits, Cali Tea is the bomb in loose leaf tea. Order yours today at calitea.com, calitea.com, and keep it loose. The World Class Holistic Expo is coming to San Diego, California in August 2012. Holistic Expo 2012 will take place August 24th through 26th at the San Diego Convention Center in beautiful Southern California. Holistic Expo 2012 will feature three conferences in one, breakout workshops, special evening events, a 45,000 square foot exhibition area, mass yoga and meditation sessions, as well as private alternative therapy sessions. It will have it all, including a great lineup of speakers. The featured speakers are best-selling author James Twyman, international spiritual leader, Dr. Bhaskaran Pillai, author and psychologist, Dr. Daniel Coleman, spiritual author, Robert Schwartz, master healer and author, Deborah King, best-selling author and life coach, Gary Quinn,
spiritual guide and shaman, Christian Zolker, erotic energy coach, Barbara Corellis, and celebrity makeup artist and life coach, Michelle Phillips. You really can't afford to miss this event. To purchase your tickets and for event information, visit www.holisticwithaw.n. That's holistic, WHOLISTIC.IN. See you there.
Okay, we're back on Mental Health Exposed with Dr. Peter Breggin, who's about to tell us what went wrong with psychiatry in America.
Well, there's a couple of things to consider. First, when in history of human beings, in any large fashion, been loving and caring toward each other rather than competitive, fighting? So, I mean, we're dealing with human nature and human history. I don't usually bring that up, but I think that's an important context. The second thing is that psychiatry has always been a public abuse. The whole root of psychiatry is in the state mental hospital system. It goes back to urbanization. Every place we had urbanization in the Western world, state mental hospitals grew up as a combination madhouse, poorhouse. They continue to this day to function that way, although now mostly, of course, we just send people out to even worse nursing homes or onto the streets. But the whole history of psychiatry is rooted in that system. The American Psychiatric Association was originally the Association of Hospital Superintendents. The Journal was originally the Journal of Hospital Superintendents. So psychiatry has always been this biological, medical, oppressive system, but it was largely limited to abusing people in the state mental hospital system. So one change is it's moved from the state hospitals out into the whole community. The hospitals are smaller, and now more and more it's just the whole community is the mental hospital. Many of our schools have more children on drugs than we used to have in our children's hospitals.
And you know what? It's a lot of the gifted kids that they do that to, the kids who are smart, creative, that think outside the box, and in many ways more so than the teacher does. And so, hey, if that's a problem, medicate them, right?
That's one thing, that psychiatry's never been anything but this biological oppressive model. Then for a brief time in the 60s, well, I guess first in the 50s, when the Jews, I'm Jewish, the Jews fled Germany, a lot of psychoanalysts, most of whom were Jewish, went to England and the U.S. and some other countries, and psychoanalysis developed for a while separately from psychiatry. And then when it turned out the analysts, many of whom were not medical people, started to, you know, earn a good living, psychiatry, especially in this country, took over psychoanalysis. But at no point was there more than 1 in 10 psychiatrists with any psychoanalytic training. They were always doing drugs and shock treatment, lobotomies, locking people in mental hospitals. Then when the insurance companies stopped paying for analysis, they said, we're not going to pay for 5 days a week. This is ridiculous. Psychoanalysis collapsed. It was just following the buck. So what you had left was the biological psychiatrist, and then this growing group of social workers, family therapists, clinical psychologists, who finally got the right to treat patients without psychiatric supervision. There was a time that you're describing where you couldn't get insurance coverage without the referral. And eventually, they got the independent right. So in places like California, women in particular stopped going. They stopped going to psychiatrists. They would go to other women. Why go to somebody who's even more uptight, angry, and controlling than your own husband or boyfriend when you can go to a social worker, psychologist, woman, or a marriage and family therapist? Well, psychiatry started going broke in the 70s. And I actually trace this history from the minutes of the board of directors of the American Psychiatric Association. I traced this history in the toxic psychiatry. And psychiatry realized it had to do something drastic. Otherwise, how could they compete with psychologists and social workers and counselors who were trained better at therapy and, I must say, are generally much nicer people and much less uptight, much less authoritarian? And what they did was decide, and this was a conscious decision, And it's actually documented in these minutes, and it occurred, of course, in many other groups and associations where we don't have the documents, that they would go to work in partnership with the drug companies and redevelop the concept that was getting lost with the psychoanalysts, redevelop the concept that everything is medical and you must have a medical doctor in charge.
Okay, so what you're saying is because these psychiatrists couldn't compete with the social workers and therapists or what have you, who actually had a vested interest in treating the patient with decency and wanting to form a relationship, that the psychiatrist had to find a way basically to regain control of the mental health community. And that's how we got into this association with Big Pharma and the diagnoses and so forth.
But how are they going to enforce that? And the only way they could do it was by convincing everybody that if you had a real problem of any kind, you had to have drugs. And if you didn't, you were unethical or criminal or bad or terrible if you didn't refer for drugs. But there's actually no reason for a psychologist or a counselor to refer anybody for drugs to a psychiatrist. There's no law. It's very unusual for anybody to get sued for not referring to a psychiatrist. Very unusual. It's always the psychiatrist is getting sued for the drugs and the shock treatment. So all the drug company money managed to work with psychiatry to convince the public they needed drugs, to convince the professionals they had to refer people for drugs, and we got the current situation we have. And it's the result of the billions of dollars invested in this program by the pharmaceutical industry. I call it the psychopharmaceutical complex. So I believe that is a very simple and accurate history of how we got to where we are today.
It is. It's quite concise. Okay, we're on with Dr. Peter Bregan, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Mental Health Exposed with Mike Bundrant on National News Radio. Love tea? So do I. Isn't it just fantastic when something that's good for you tastes great too? If you haven't tried Cali tea, you're missing out. How does nutty orange spice, white bubbly berry, or fruity cherry banana sound to you? This amazing loose leaf tea from Cali Tea is a treat to your taste buds, and the health benefits are fantastic. From its antioxidants to its cardiovascular health benefits, Cali Tea is the bomb in loose leaf tea. Order yours today at calitea.com, calitea.com, and keep it loose.
World-class Holistic Expo is coming to San Diego, California in August 2012. Holistic Expo 2012 will take place August 24th through 26th at the San Diego Convention Center in beautiful Southern California. Holistic Expo 2012 will feature three conferences in one, breakout workshops, special evening events, a 45,000 square foot exhibition area, mass yoga and meditation sessions, as well as private alternative therapy sessions. It will have it all, including a great lineup of speakers. The featured speakers are best-selling author James Twyman, international spiritual leader Dr. Bhaskaran Pillai, author and psychologist Dr. Daniel Coleman, spiritual author Robert Schwartz, master healer and author Deborah King, best-selling author and life coach Gary Quinn, spiritual guide and shaman Christian Zolker, erotic energy coach Barbara Corellis, and celebrity makeup artist and life coach Michelle Phillips. You really can't afford to miss this event. To purchase your tickets and for event information, visit www.holisticwithaw.n. That's holistic, holistic.in. See you there.
So great to have you here, Dr. Bregan. That was a concise history. And it absolutely underscores the point, follow the money. And it also, one thing I learned from it, from having been a part of the system, The people that I got supervision from, they preached fear, which is if you don't refer, if somebody comes in and they use the word depression and you don't refer them for a medication evaluation, first of all, if I didn't document that in my notes, I could lose my job. And the reason was because we didn't want to be sued, because if that person went and killed themselves and it was discovered that we didn't provide every means available to them to get better, then I was putting our agency at risk. Now, this is one of the reasons I left managed care, because I found myself routinely lying to my supervisors because I wouldn't, in fact, refer them to medication, because I felt like the first time I said, okay, I'm going to refer you for medication evaluation, I just undermined the therapeutic process that I was working on.
That's right. You've said to the patient, we can't do this together. We're not good enough.
And now we go back to the issue that you raised of trust, establishing a safe environment for people to work in, and really wanted to help. And why would I throw a wrench in the spokes there? And so I'm lying now to my supervisors in order to, you know, keep my own internal integrity intact. And it's really quite a system. And to hear you say, you know what? It's not common for a therapist or someone to get sued because they didn't recommend drugs. The flip side is actually the more common lawsuit.
Well, the easy way to figure that one out is who pays the highest insurance premiums, not the routine therapist. It's the psychiatrist, because they're constantly hurting people with their drugs. I think this is an important point for young and even older therapists to understand, whether you're a counselor or a clinical social worker, psychologist, family therapist, and that is people get sued almost always because they've been mistreated. Not mistreated by AMA or APA standards, mistreated by human standards. Most people sue when they feel they've been misused, abused, ignored. Families sue after suicide when the doctors have not included them in the treatment, or when the doctors haven't answered desperate phone calls about how bad their family member is doing, or when doctors have given drugs every, you know, and seen the patient every 6 months. It's very rare for anyone to sue a therapist who is very caring and very ethical in treatment. That's the first thing that's very, very important. Secondly, it's now established that the drugs psychiatrists use most cause suicide. The antidepressants, the mood stabilizers, Strattera, and also, although there's not a warning, specific black box warning, the stimulants we give kids all cause suicidality, and there is no medication approved for treating suicidality. So it becomes a very hard argument to make that you should have referred the patient for drugs that cause suicide when the patient's suicidal. And the other issue is that suicide is going to be really uncommon in your practice if you're just caring about your patients and every word that comes out of your mouth is to empower them.
Exactly. And this goes to another point. And by the way, before we lose it, I want to talk about another thing you've identified called chronic brain impairment. But I want to make another point first, which is what you're talking about. And I think readers or listeners and therapists need to understand this, which is the skill of the counselor or the psychiatrist, the people skills, the therapeutic process. That's what does the healing, not necessarily the medication. However, it is much easier and requires a less competent person to refer on for a medication evaluation or to prescribe medication according to some cookie cutter diagnoses and a list of the meds according to the pharmaceutical rep that work for these things. It's easier to do that. It's much easier to medicate people than to help them come to terms with their history, to help them sort out their family dynamics, to create a relationship of trust and compassion and to be a mentor for that person in many ways. That requires requires gifts and a skill set, and perhaps not enough people have that skill set. I mean, we're talking about the work that you're doing. We're talking about Jay Haley. I know Milton Erickson was quite gifted. There's a lot of a whole host of well-known therapists, but these people are the exception rather than the rule. So, are there really good therapists out there? Can they be trained? I mean, or are we talking about the exception?
I don't have the answer, believe it or not, but I've been puzzling over these issues since I was working in the state mental hospital at age 18 and trying to figure out which of the students that I was leading was going to be a good therapist or not, and whether I was going to be a good therapist or not. I think that you can certainly encourage empathy and discourage oppression and help bring out the best in somebody. Just like you raise a child, you raise yourself, you get raised by your supervisors. So I think you can certainly help create an environment that will encourage empathy. Psychiatry does the exact opposite.
Yeah, but
it literally brings out the worst.
You're not saying, though, that the cure for schizophrenia is to go to somebody's office and have them be nice to you.
That's the start. Do you remember Aaron Esterson? He wrote with R.D. Lang, wrote one of the best books ever on schizophrenia, called The Family or something close to that. But it's R.D. Lang and Aaron Esterson. And Aaron and I sat down in front of a group one day in England to be the wise old heads sharing our views. And he'd been treating people labeled schizophrenic his whole life. And somebody said, What's the key? How do you treat a schizophrenic person? And Aaron thought, and he said them very courteously. And it's the truth. The whole thing is to use when somebody is really, really disturbed, is to use every kind and caring and thoughtful skill that you have. I call it bring out the best in yourself to bring out the best in the other human being. And the skill is to be able to do that when the other person is looking crazy and scared, and for you not to get crazy and scared yourself. When the other person has an emergency, you don't have an emergency, which is one of the key things I teach people. If as therapists, you don't have emergencies. The patient has them. They come in. They find that their emergency is not creating an emergency in you, they're going to calm down. But if you start talking drugs, then they really know they got an emergency, or hospitals, or that they got to send them to somebody else. No, you want to be the opposite of an emergency. Just some really basic things about how to be with a distressed person. And yes, you see it work with the most disturbed people. In 5 and 10 minutes, you see people begin to calm down. And very often, in my experience, the therapy with the family only lasts a few months. Whereas with people who are locked in after 35, 40 years, into their patterns of behavior, it can take a very, very long time. And it's not that the person's going to be cured of being a human being and not have suffering and anguish. Often these people who have breakdowns early on are very sensitive people, very creative people, and they're going to have their struggles. But yes, the starting point for helping somebody who's disturbed is to really connect. And I think, in psychiatry, we get so weird so that even the so-called great therapists, they would sit for 6 months, the old analysts, and not talk to the patient.
Right.
Patient would come in and wait for them to talk for 6 months or 3 months. And the person sitting with their hair in their eyes, and finally they, there's a film about this. That person looks up after three months and parts their hair, and it's a big deal. When I would be saying to a 16-year-old right away, would you just kind of look at me for a minute? I feel better. I could just see your face. Would you mind? Just for a sec. Give me a little glance. And that thing that took them 6 months would be done in 30 seconds.
Right.
Because they'd hear the kindness in my voice and the welcome. So, it's common sense. It's direct. And I have some quarrels with that we may not want to get into at all, but I have some disagreements with Jay Haley and these other approaches because they were not totally honest and forthcoming kinds of approaches. They were very manipulative approaches. And
they had an agenda. It started
they had
with
agenda.
I know the problem, I know the solution, and I'm going to direct you toward the solution. And was that solution? So it was a filter. And what you're talking about is not necessarily having a filter other than this person in my office is a person. And you treat them like a person.
Yeah, the person who is really afraid to connect to anybody, and it's my skill is going to, you're a person whisperer.
I get it. The healing is in the connection between people. We will be right back with Dr. Peter Breggin.
You're listening to Mental Health Exposed with Mike Bundren on National News Radio. Love tea? So do I. Isn't it just fantastic when something that's good for you tastes great too? If you haven't tried Cali tea, you're missing out. How does nutty orange spice, white bubbly berry, or fruity cherry banana sound to you? This amazing loose leaf tea from Cali Tea is a treat to your taste buds, and the health benefits are fantastic. From its antioxidants to its cardiovascular health benefits, Cali Tea is the bomb in loose leaf tea. Order yours today at calitea.com, calitea.com, and keep it loose.
World-Class Holistic Expo is coming to San Diego, California in August 2012. Holistic Expo 2012 will take place August 24th through 26th at the San Diego Convention Center in beautiful Southern California. Holistic Expo 2012 will feature three conferences in one, breakout workshops, special evening events, a 45,000 square foot exhibition area, mass yoga and meditation sessions, as well as private alternative therapy sessions. It will have it all, including a great lineup of speakers. The featured speakers are best-selling author James Twyman, international spiritual leader Dr. Bhaskaran Pillai, author and psychologist Dr. Daniel Coleman, spiritual author Robert Schwartz, master healer and author Deborah King, best-selling author and life coach Gary Quinn, spiritual guide and shaman Christian Zolker, erotic energy coach Barbara Corellis, and celebrity makeup artist and life coach Michelle Phillips. You really can't afford to miss this event. To purchase your tickets and for event information, visit www.holisticwithaw.n. That's holistic, holistic.in. See you there.
Okay, we're back with the person whisperer, Dr. Peter Breggin.
I never used that phrase in my life before. You're somebody who's going to be at least as gentle and kind as a dog whisperer or a horse whisperer is. And your task is pretty much the same because you've got some being that's really scared, probably because of a lot of abuse of one kind or another, if only just emotional rejection and neglect. And your job is to help them think that for a few minutes they're safe. And with children, for example, with diagnosed with ADHD, for example, I'm not talking about children who are, you know, at the age of 12 or already completely destroyed by dysfunctional families. Did you get your kids labeled ADHD or want to tear up your office? I've never had one that didn't calm down in my office in the first half hour. And then I could look at the family and say, what, this is a disease, but it got better, and little Jimmy's listening to me like he's glued to me. In fact, notice right now he's practically sitting on my lap looking at me. This is not a disease. One of my favorite stories, and it's a very true story, is the one child that couldn't calm down, a 10-year-old with an extremely anxious mother who'd just gotten back from an abusive weekend with her father. She was really beyond ADHD, but she was really agitated and anxious, and I couldn't calm her down. And finally, I asked Mom to wait in the waiting room with the door open so she'd be very nearby because I could see she was raising the daughter's anxiety. And I asked this little girl if she liked dogs, and she said yes. I said, well, I have this miniature collie. Boy, her eyes just bug right up. Miniature collie. I said, called a Shetland sheepdog. Looks like a little collie. But he's got arthritis, you know, pain in his joints. So you'll have to be really gentle if I bring him in. So I bring my dog in, and the whirling dervish sits while my dog sort of gently approaches her. He's kind of elderly. He's gone now, Teddy. And then sits beside her, and she pets him for the rest of the session. So, I bring mom back in. I say, what kind of disease is this? She's just been told an NIMH, because my office when I was in Bethesda was right near NIMH. She came to me frantic after going to NIMH. And she and her daughter had both been told she couldn't control herself, that this was like her brakes were broken. She had a disease. And I said
somebody
to them,
somebody said that in the presence of this little girl?
Oh, they do it all the time. They give them books. They give them books about the child with broken brakes. The engine with broken brakes. It's a powerful little sports car, but its brakes don't work. They make them into objects in books, let alone what they say.
And this is my point. What you described with this little girl and bringing in your dog is actually a very sophisticated piece of work where, one, you recognize that the mother's anxiety had an effect on the daughter, and that if the mother is there and anxious herself, even internally, the daughter's going to have a hard time calming down. You recognize where the daughter came from in the last week, and so you knew enough to send the mother out, and you knew your effect, the dog's effect on the daughter would be much greater. You altered the context so that the context encouraged the girl to calm down. You put her in a situation in which there really was no choice because of her compassion for this dog, where she had to be gentle. In other words, this is a sophisticated piece of work. And I'm suggesting that it's easier, especially for a less intelligent person to say, oh yeah, you've got something wrong with you. It's like your brakes are broken or something like that. Here's some drugs to calm you down.
Yeah. But I don't think it's intelligence. Because some of the most intelligent people in the world are milking this drug system for all it's worth. I think, and my mind doesn't quite work the way you're describing it. I can be very intellectual. You know, I've written 20 plus books, so, and, you know, dozens of scientific articles. I can be conceptual out the roof. But that's not where I'm at. I'm not thinking I'm going to manipulate the context. I'm just sitting there with this human being, and I'm seeing mom's anxious. I'm seeing she's anxious. I'm open about it. Mom, I can see you're anxious. And why don't you step out a little bit? Let me see what, you know, if things will relax a little bit. And then I'm thinking, oh, this little girl, I need help. You know, where's help? Ah, I'll bring in my dog because I need some help here. It's a direct human. It's so much more like just ordinary caring. And yes, it takes skills and sophistication you learn with time, but it isn't a very abstract process at all, for me at least.
Right, right. We could break it down and even turn it into a teaching model, but now we've just created...
I want it to be an empathic model, not
an agenda or a protocol.
That's right, not at all.
Right.
I'll ask my patient what they want from me.
Right.
What at this moment can I give you that you really, really need? And quite often the response will be, oh, just by asking me, you're giving me so much of the first doc ever asked me.
Boy, if that doesn't point something out, that's the elusive.
Oh, I do. Yeah,
obvious,
I see couples that have seen three or four couples therapists over the years, and not one of them have asked them if they love each other. And I ask them in the first 6 minutes, and it's like, nobody ever asked us.
Right.
I mean, it's like basic life stuff. And I think that there are a lot of people who have these skills, but they're not the people who go in naturally to medicine. And now they're definitely not the people who go into psychiatry. See, when I went into psychiatry by an unusual route, I was actually a reformer with some effect and force when I was 18, 19 years old, writing in articles and books and giving speeches about our program. So mine came in differently. But a lot of people came in literally, as we used to joke, the Jewish doctor who couldn't stand blood. You get into med school, you find out you have problems, you get some therapy, and you think this helps. Wow, I'll help people. It's a very good route to come in. You come in with your own issues and your own problems. You find you can get help. You want to help others. That doesn't happen at all anymore. Now you've taken a drug and it helps. or you just want to give a drug to somebody. So instead of sort of the neurotic, you know, struggling, ordinary human being like the rest of us who wants to be a therapist because it helps, you're this controlling, distant human being. That's the modern psychiatrist. The out-of-touch, authoritarian, controlling human being, a very different than your typical psychotherapist, you know, who tends to be a shy person with some issues and he's comfortable in his office and likes working with people. I'm just so comfortable in my office compared to most social settings. So, you know, the problem is that we're recruiting from the wrong group. If I was going to start recruiting anywhere for therapists, I think I would look to women whose children had left the nest and say, how'd you like to start helping folks again? And I'd set up a training program that would take 6 months. They could charge $25 an hour and be very happy, and we could have lots of people doing therapy. But, you know, the model, it would be hard to get across in this licensure society.
Yeah, it sure would. Well, tell me about the empathic therapy. I know you've got an organization going on. You've got a conference coming up. I mean, you're obviously making moves in this direction.
Yes. I had an organization I founded back in the 70s. And then when my wife joined me in the 80s, she really made it into a big organization. And we ran big conferences. And then we stepped back for a while, in part because Ginger was not well for a while. Back around 2000, we stepped back and we gave it over to other people, and we were the emeritus parents of the organization. And then we didn't like the direction it was going in at all. So we split and we started all over again. Mm-hmm. And 2 years ago, we set up the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. The longer title is the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education and Living. And we have a webpage, empathictherapy.org. We have a free newsletter, e-newsletter, goes to about 3,000 people. My wife runs an incredible professional Facebook in my name. She runs it occasionally. I enter in a little bit. And it's just a very vital organization. I think we have 6,000 people on my Facebook already, all this just within the last year or two. And last year we had a meeting of about 200 people in Syracuse, and we're going to do the same thing this year, April 13th through 15th. It's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 13th through 15th. It's in Syracuse, New York. It'll be one of the least expensive conferences you've ever gone to because we're not trying to make money. In fact, we've put money into it because this is what we believe in doing. We've been blessed. I have a good income from books, practice, legal work. So it's an inexpensive conference, and it's just got fabulous people doing the same kind of thing you do, Mike. Part of it is critiquing what's the matter with biological modern psychiatry, and the other is about offering alternatives.
Wow, that sounds like a really amazing weekend.
We're going to have a woman who's a department director of counseling in Rochester, who is going to, Catherine Doughtit, who's going to be talking about how to help elderly, demented people with human relationship. You know, the people we just warehouse and drug, and the marvelous effects you can have. We're going to be talking about helping children. We're going to be talking about therapy in general. There'll be an evening where I just have a conversation with people, me and my friend Bert Caron, who's been psychologist of the year at APA and is probably the grandest psychologist standing in America today. He's retired, marvelous man. He and I will just have a conversation with people about empathic therapy. By the way, if you go to my website, I also have a training video on empathic therapy, which will be so cheap again. Not going to make a lot of money on it. Wanted to get it out into the world. The website is my website's Breggin.com. Breggin.com. And from that website, you can get to the others or go right to empathictherapy.org. If you want to support the movement, reform in psychiatry, I think the best thing you can do is come to our conference, meet people, encourage people, support the conference. You'll You'll feel like, I think you'll feel like it's the best conference you've ever been to in your life, because the whole environment is created in line with the values that this is going to be a caring, empathic experience.
Okay, this is Mental Health Exposed on Natural News Radio. We've been on with Dr. Peter Breggin. You can find Dr. Breggin at Breggin, BREGGIN.com, or empathic. I'll say it again, Dr. Breggin.
Just empathictherapy.org.
Empathictherapy.org. It's been great to have you. You know, we're winding down on our time here. We did not get to one of the topics I've been wanting to talk with you about, which is chronic brain impairment. And that just tells me I'm going to need to interview you again for a future show sometime, because that is an important topic that I want to get the word out on.
Yeah, I think it is very, very important. I mean, in a nutshell, the psychiatric drugs, it's now clear that all of them are producing long-term harm to the brain. Shouldn't have been a surprise. And it just isn't a good thing to stay on these drugs indefinitely. But if you're going to come off, you have to come off carefully, because they all produce withdrawal problems. It's best to have some wise clinical supervision. But it is not a good idea to stay on any of these psychoactive substances long term.
And people can read more about CBI or chronic brain impairment on your website. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. My article, it just came out in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. If you put in chronic brain impairment on the search mechanism on the website, you'll get to it. If that doesn't work, just go to scientific papers, and it should be at the top of some of the groups of my scientific papers. But a lot of the basic information is in my two most recent books, you know, Medication Madness and Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition.
Okay, Dr. Peter Breggin, thanks so much for being on the show. Great to have you. I'm honored to have you as my first
guest. And good luck with your new show. Be a success. Listen to him, folks. You're not going to get this too many places.
That's great. Okay, thanks so much. And remember, you owe me another interview about CBI.
Anytime.
You're listening to Mental Health Exposed with Mike Bundren on National News Radio.
All right, let's talk about what this means. Does it mean that all psychiatrists are evil, or that your psychiatrist, if you have one, doesn't know how to help you? Of course not. Should you abandon your treatment with your psychiatrist or stop taking your medication if you take it? No, absolutely not. Are we giving you medical advice? No, of course not. So what are the takeaways? Here it is in a nutshell, in my view. Let's question the assumption that anyone cares more about your well-being than you do. Let's question whether or not the accepted treatments or the medical model is the best way to approach mental health. And most of all, take responsibility for your own mind and your own emotions. No one else and no substance replaces that fundamental individual responsibility. When you give that responsibility up, you set yourself up to be taken advantage of. And, you know, my personal takeaway from this conversation with Dr. Breggin is to reconsider the role of trust in my life and really question it. It's worth questioning. Do I trust the people that are closest to me with my deepest thoughts and my feelings? How much do I withhold myself from them? How much do I refrain from saying to them or sharing with them because I don't trust them? And what I mean by that is because I fear being judged, or I fear being criticized. How safe do I feel with the people in my life? And importantly, how safe are they with me? Can they trust me? How quick am I to judge, to assume things, to criticize, or react poorly? And I know on this show, we've been talking about the mentally ill. We've been talking about people with schizophrenia and so forth. But in my view, it's all on a scale. All of this factors into all of our lives, regardless of our state of mental health. If I live my life every day with a fear of being judged by someone who's close to me, my level of stress is going to be a lot higher than if I feel fundamentally safe and secure in my relationships. So I really think Dr. Breggin's most powerful point is the role of trust. How safe do we feel in the world, and how strong are our connections with other people. And that's our inaugural show. Thanks so much to Dr. Breggin for joining us. And my hat's off to Mike Adams of Natural News for creating the Natural News Radio Network. And I'm so grateful to be a part of it. Thanks so much to Natural News. And most of all, to our producer, my lovely wife, Hope. She is the one who makes this show possible. Join us next week on Mental Health Exposed when our guest will be Dr. Andrew Saul of DrYourself.com. You won't believe what this man has to say.
Mental Health Exposed is sponsored by the INLP Center. The INLP Center is an online personal growth site providing online personal development courses, life coaching, and certification in neuro-linguistic programming, all from the comfort of your laptop. Want to start making those changes you intended back on January 1st? Now you can. INLP Center is offering a free mini course entitled 3 Soul-Stirring Questions to Reveal Your Deepest Self-Improvement Goals. Just visit them online to download this free course right now. Visit INLPCenter.com. More NLP, less hype.